options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest.
Morning, happy Friday. I think I'm one of the few people in this world that gets a little less happy on Friday because I don't get to play the game again tomorrow, but we'll wait till Monday. That's why Sunday's super happy, because we get ready for Monday. But happy times, happy days, as we'd say in Ireland, happy days, because India hit a new high, Q's hit a new all-time high. It took, you know, bloody well took the Q's all the way back to 2021 to find those highs, you know, again. And again and again, we didn't have you bag holding or wearing cues, you know, to the lows of 2022. We do it differently. We don't nail everything, but we don't get you nailed, is the point. And it is good to be long India. India put up an 8.4% GDP number. Yeah, if you don't know how big that is, you just got to know. Howard, it's big to be in Florida on a Friday.
It is. It feels good to be in Florida. I'm not here much longer, unfortunately. Three things for me though, Keith, this morning: between Cava, Portillo's, and I forgot the last company, three restaurant companies, Portillo's, Cava, and I forget the one, $580 million was raised in between secondary and, registered and not registered offerings, $580 million of insider selling this quarter in just this week alone in the restaurant space. Wow. Second thing is we got the numbers out of Beyond Meat this week, and they basically said they're going to raise equity and not go bankrupt. And then today they announced they can't file their 10K.
Oh, no.
I mean, you just can't make this up. And the stock's up 50% in the last month. I think it was up 30% on the day. I mean, just... And then lastly, for me, Sweetgreen's reported last night, 5% comp. It beat the street pretty handily. 6% comp, 5% price, 1% mix. So they beat the numbers pretty handily. You can do that when you're raising prices aggressively. The conference call was all bullish around the Infinite Kitchen, which they're going to remodel their stores and add all this technology in, which lowers labor costs and improve margins. But there's one question that nobody would ask on the call, and that is, what happens to depreciation on your income statement when you invest all this technology in your stores? And back of the envelope, because I don't know the exact answer, but back of the envelope, I'm going to say that nearly all the labor benefits they get from taking labor out of the stores because you're putting technology in will be mitigated by higher depreciation amortization. So no change. We'll have an updated thesis for Sweetgreen's for us this morning, but there's no change. The stock's going to be up a little bit this morning, but and they do think they can be profitable next year, but they have been unable to hit any guidance they've given since being a public company. So
We like, Howard likes, therefore, and the Signal likes, let's just reorder that. The Signal likes and Howard likes Cava. If you're looking for a restaurant IPO, that's the one, Cava. All right, good, thanks. Beolsi, you're like a kind of like a fan favorite now. You got like sexy stock, you know, it's Celsius only 24 hours ago. I mean, and a lot of people said this on Twitter and otherwise. Like, if I was a HedgEye subscriber, I wouldn't tweet shit, right? Like, I just keep it to myself. So, because I just selfishly want the alpha. I don't want everybody else to know where I'm making money. Yeah. And that's what the buy side, of course, does as well. They don't tweet. But some people participate out loud. We're fine with that. And a lot of people are complimenting you on this because you could have bought this in the pre-market down.
Yeah. It was a day. I had a day yesterday for sure. And I have to enjoy it when it happens, right?
And look, we can hear you this morning. Your connection's good. Yeah, I thought you were going to be exhausted, man.
Well, I'm grateful you gave me a minute to fix the technical issues I had yesterday so I can go over both Synopta and Celsius. You know, for the pitch, I had to convince Eric that my Wi-Fi would be fine, but, you know, I really had no idea. I did that from a service hallway on my knees in order to get that Celsius pitch out there.
Oh, geez.
Yeah, I really wanted to get that story out there. You know, it's my top long, so. But, you know, we have to move on, right? So I think the next Synopta can be Perigo, P-R-G-O. Not immediately, of course. You know, wait for the signal, your signal. You know, we have some time, but I think, you know, Synopta sold off because of bad business. You know, they sold off a bad business that the street didn't really understand how much it would help them. It's like getting rid of a teammate. You don't realize how good a team can be, in this case, a company, right? And they still don't. So that's Synopta. But for Perigo, in terms of, you know, a problem being one time, it's not an impaired business, but the market is treating the EPS revision like it's a structural, you know, impairment to that business. It's going to come back sooner than the market expects. So that's one for the next time. So maybe I got some people's attention for Synopta. Keep Perigo on the radar and watch for your signal. And I think that will be next. The CEO.
Well, yeah, and you get people's attention, all right. I mean, the only way Perigo could potentially be a Synopta is if it blows up, right? And it has. So you have, because it's not like Synopta didn't go from the teens to like $3 or $4 a share. Now it's breaking out the bullish trend again. So again, these are very good examples of, you know, having the patience to wait and watch, but not take them off your, like, these are all pieces of inventory on my screens, right? Like, to me, they're just tickers. And one day, just like yesterday on STKL, which is Synopta, I'll see an immediate term trade and trend breakout that, you know, I don't have to wear Synopta from 15 to 3 or 4. I get to buy it at 6 or 7. And that's right. Fine. You know, like, our process isn't built to buy bottoms. Like, I've tried it. It's a very stinky business picking bottoms. And it's like low probability. And I don't know what else you need. But for me, I prefer to stay with, again, especially in this day and age when the machine really punishes losers and perpetuates winners. Like, the machine loves momentum, you know, both ways. So that's you know, I'll certainly be paying attention to PRGO.
Yeah, I've never heard that picking bottoms is a stinky business. So the CEO bought stock yesterday at Perigo. So that's something else to flag.
Well, there you see, he the machine doesn't care about him, but, you know, it's he cares. That's good. You want to see that? All right. Is that it?
No, so my note, we don't have to go in detail. My note today has comments on Bud and Utz, you know, short Bud, buy Utz. The quick on Utz is UTZ is the symbol. The setup for Utz in 2024 is the best the company's had in like 4 years. You know, they've been really hit with supply chain and inflationary surge, really hard for them to raise prices and deal with the shortages they had. So this is the best setup they have, and I don't think they're going to waste it. So they've set up a nice guide, beat and raise. And the details are in my note. That's it.
Yep. Okay. Thank you. Jinx.
Hey, good morning, Keith. Wanted to talk about Macau GGR trends because we do have finalized February data. I think we need to look at February and January in conjunction as we compare versus pre-COVID period. Last year, the Macau market was still opening, so the year-over-year comps are a little bit wonky, but either way, looks like the headline number is maybe a little bit light of what is being circulated as consensus expectations. I kind of laugh because the Macau market and the dynamics with, you know, modeling monthly numbers and stuff, like, there's not a real consensus because we no longer have the same visibility intra-month that we used to have before COVID, where there were multiple consultants in the market and you had a better feel for, you know, what activity was across the properties. Instead, there's only one consultant left in the market, and there's like four or five people that actually try to model, you know, monthly volatility around these GGR prints. So it long-winded way of saying, I think when you see headlines that say things are below or above consensus, you know, you kind of can ignore them a little bit more nowadays and just focus on really, you know, the reality of the data, or at least as we see it. And, you know, I think February is a continuation of really a solid trend. So if you look at January and February together, because you had Chinese New Year shift back into February this year. And if you look at, you know, you got to look at the sort of combined months. So December GGR trends had accelerated from November was down 30. Then December was only down 19. By the way, these numbers imply that mass revenues, where all the profits are actually up versus 19, right? Because you don't have a VIP segment. That business is basically down 80, 90% versus pre-COVID. So November down 30, going to down 19. And then the combination of January and February, you're down mid-20s, actually down 24%. So a little bit of a pullback from the December month, right? But an acceleration from where we were coming out of the fall and into November. And I think if you look at sort of the, you know, an annualized number for what February put up, it's actually the highest rate of GGR production on a monthly basis going back really since before COVID. So I'm coming at this fairly positive, because what might be lost on folks is that Chinese New Year was really strong. Typically, once you come out of the Chinese New Year period, visitation levels fall off and you get a VIP or very high-end gambling component that comes into the market. They don't want the crowds and what have you. That's the historical context. That's what used to happen. I think people are getting a little bit too bogged down in comparing, well, this implies the second half of February was really slow. Because if we trust our Chinese New Year numbers, then and then look at the, you know, the full month, and we can imply that the sort of daily volumes were slower. Well, you're comparing against a period that is entirely different than what is now, which is there is no VIP customer. It's an entirely different market. In fact, it's a much more profitable market than it was pre-COVID. So I think there's a little bit of there's still issues with comparisons and how people look at things. And I think for us, it's, you know, we could take a step back and take a little bit more nuanced view of what is actually going on, which is, you know, numbers continue to trend higher. You're going to have a quarter or a month or two where things pull back a little bit. But generally speaking, and now coupled with the macro looking a little bit better as we move further into the year, I think the setup continues to look really solid. So any pullback on below expectations, I think, needs to be put into context. And the context here is actually really positive and that's my takeaway, at least on February GGR. So the trend continues to accelerate and the recovery continues to push ahead here in Macau. So win is the obvious takeaway that we've discussed, but LVS also looks interesting. And then, you know, I'd argue MGM China for those that can play the Hong Kong listed names, or MGM as well if you're looking for the Vegas exposure and domestic exposure. Those three tickers will be top of mind, but Wynn being really more at the heart of it, given that close to 50% of their consolidated EBITDA is coming from Macau. And that's it for today.
I'm not going to tell you that I told you, but earlier in the week, I told you that you were going to tell me this on Friday.
It won't be the last time, Keith.
This damn signal.
It's not the first time.
I'm telling you, these damn signals, you know, from the gods, you know, fractal Floki god, he is. And I have prepared, you know, for those of you that don't know how that signal, the signal is built through many, many years of mistakes as a practitioner to front run myself fundamentally. Right. So now I, like a boss, I front run Jenkins and what he's going to say by 3 or 4 days from now. I'm going to call him a little later and we're going to talk about quantum mechanics and path integrals. And then, you know, then we're going to go on with our day. Okay.
Let's do it. Good stuff.
It was a great marriage. We had a last night, I sent out a note to the team. You know, what Sean did was he really, you know, put together a good, you know, macro to micro note on Wynn. And for those of you that with a preamble to it, and then for those of you that have investing ideas, which, like real-time coaching alerts, is an entirely different product now because we've evolved it and learned from it and taken your feedback. And these guys create these fantastic, not one pagers, but very easy to consume stock reports, so that, you know, like really in a page and a half, you know, why you're going to be long win for the long term, or at least as long as we stay with it. So that was excellent research, Sean. So I just wanted to say that.
Oh, thanks. Well, it's always good when we can team up. I think when the signal matches fundamentals or front runs fundamentals and gets us to sharpen the saw a little bit more, it only makes us better and helps us, our clients, make more money, obviously.
Exactly.
Which is the goal here.
We had all three. We had the signal, of course, was earlier in the week on Wynn. Then we got China from a signaling and factor exposure perspective to go bullish. So we had a big macro catalyst, which is also the subject matter of the early look note this morning, we're getting like big breakouts and big things like oil, China, like those are huge things. India is not a new breakout. That's a bull market that we've been long since June of last year, right? One of the best asset allocations we've ever made. But these are big things that are happening as you come out of a global recession. So this weekend, when people say, people call it a recession, just shut up. Just shut up. That's what you say. Shut up. I'm going to tell you to shut up.
Focus on the next play, right?
Yeah, well, we had a global recession and we're coming out of it in China. So again, there's not subject to debate. We had a recession in Germany. We're coming out of it. Same thing. Well, Canada is not as clear, but there are plenty of places. UK, everybody in the UK knows. I mean, in the US, you didn't have one, but you had plenty of recessionary data and or companies that imploded all the while. All right, let's go. I got to keep going here. McGough.
Yeah, good morning. I'd love if you could tell me what I'm going to be talking about in a couple of days, because I often don't know what the hell I'm going to say until it comes out of my mouth.
Why don't you start talking and I'm going to look at a couple of things. I'm going to go to my quantum mechanic and path integral machine here.
All right. Well, so today is a day I've been waiting for about 2 weeks now. We're having our call with Marcus Lemonis, chairman of Beyond, BYON. It's a best idea long. He's also the CEO of Camping World Holdings, CWH, which I'm looking at that stock chart right now. I'm really curious as to what that looks like as far as signal strength. That's on our long bias list, but we are going to talk about that too. And just the punchline on Camping World is this guy has been in the down cycle. He's rolled up the industry. He's basically told competitors, these mom and pops, hey, I'm either buying you at 3x EBITDA or I'm opening up a dealership down the street I'm putting you out of business. So take it or leave it. So this guy is just ruthless. I'm really looking forward to in this conversation later today at 12:30, really getting behind. We'll ask him the usual questions, but I really want to get behind what makes this guy tick. And really understand his motivations. Obviously, a big motivation is his stock price, which he's incentivized on both companies. It should be a really good conversation. And then we're following up after the Marcus conversation, which will be an hour long, with Mark Cahotas, a friend of the firm, bull on both of these names. I'm not a bull on just because Mark is. Mark has pitched me on them for years and I haven't gotten on board. I wait until our own research gives me the signal. And then ultimately when you give me the signal is when I get really loud. It should be a great event, which I'm really looking forward to. So that's on BYON and CWH, both long ideas, which, you know, if I'm right on them, they're not going up by 30-40%. These are very typical Brian McGough multi-baggers. And when they move, they're going to move very swiftly and solidly. But speaking of big moves.
I consulted my machine. I think what you're going to be talking about is Gildan.
You think so, huh?
It doesn't have to be today, but in the coming days, crystal balling this thing by sometime next week, you're going to be saying something very bullish about Gildan Activewear.
Well, Jeremy McLean is probably licking his chops right now because that's one of his favorite names. And when it's one of his favorites, it's one of mine. You know, it's funny with this conversation later with Mark and Marcus, you're going to have like me on one end, the kind of longer term strategic thinker. I'm the dreamer, right? And then you got Jeremy there, who's the more near-term, model-focused, pragmatic guy who's got to keep my feet on the ground. And that's why Jeremy and I balance each other out so damn well. Jeremy's a big fan of you. But one name I did want to touch on this morning is The Real Real. R-E-A-L is the ticker. It's a best idea long. And this stock is a bone. Let's be clear about that. It's trading at $1.75. It's actually ripping now post-market because of the quarter the company put up last night. And I'm not going to go through all the nits and picks of the quarter. The punchline is that the company had a blowout quarter. They restructured their 2025 debt. They generated positive EBITDA for the first time since the company went public, which is ahead of plan. So if it, like, I get so many bears on the buy side who tell me, oh, now this thing's going bankrupt. It won't make it. It won't make it. You can objectively look at these numbers that this company put up last night and say it's not going to make it. So I know we don't like buying on green, but, you know, my message to institutions is that this is a $2 stock right now. If I'm right on the tail call, it's going to 10. And you just got proof positive that this company is probably going to make it, very highly likely going to make it. It's about to anniversary a decline in GMV as it cut out low-priced negative margin items on its P&L. And in its business, it's starting to source supply because this is a supply-driven business, not a demand-driven business. It's all about the product that they get. This is a company that sells luxury products secondhand. So you can buy a $20,000 Hermes Birkin bag on RealReal. You can buy a $40,000 Rolex watch. And it's all about getting good supply. They're going to start sourcing that from some luxury locations globally instead of just inside the US. I think they've got in their back pocket a deal with Kering, which owns Gucci, to be the exclusive off-price retailer for excess Gucci merchandise that can't sell. That's a big kicker. I could go up and down a laundry list of business drivers here, but ultimately, this company just generated $2 million in EBITDA. I know that's nothing, but it had been, you know, it was like negative 20 last year. So very big rate of change. Pod one is going to start to accelerate in about two quarters. And pod two is already accelerating. Pod three looks very good. Their capital expenditures are going down. So free cash flow is going up. And I just think the pods are going to be going this company's way at a point where we're in a much better quad environment, whether it be quad one or quad two, hopefully quad two. Names like this really work, and they work big in quad two. Institutions won't be looking at this stock until it triples, just because it's a bone and they aren't allowed to buy bones. Or at least most of them aren't. But if you're not an institution, it's one I would seriously look at here. This was a very big proof positive that this company will continue to exist and exist quite well over a tail duration. So we're bullish on the RealReal, REAL, best idea long. Good day today for us on that one. And that's all I got.
Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at HedgeEye. Hope you're enjoying our podcast. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street. Go to HedgeEye.com/research to subscribe. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
I mean, this thing... I mean, I dare you all to pull up a 3 to 5 year chart on Real, REAL. Just, it's going to open your eyes to the possibilities of things. Okay? So there's a lot, and there are a lot of stocks. Like back to what I said about the recession. I mean, it was a bloody depression in McGough world. Like these, and I appreciate it. We do appreciate you being on. I know sometimes I'm, you know, doing a little bit too much coaching, and not everybody has been coached at a high level. But, you know, like if you're new to us this week and you've joined us and you're like, oh, that's the firm that was bearish last year. Yeah. But we were also bearish the year before that, you know, and before everything crashed. And we stayed bearish on things that still were bearish last year, which included like basically all of Brian McGough's universe, including his long ideas. So it's just, it's a thing, right? Like, you know, Wall Street, you know, if you're watching the comedic, you know, representation of it on CNBC, which is the longest running comedy in cable. You know, you, of course, you, the only thing you see or hear is like about one stock, NVIDIA or SPY or whatever, the Dow in points. I mean, it's just, it's pathetic, right? It's pathetic and it's sad, but here's your opportunity. Their opportunity here is to build a very unique portfolio of long ideas, if that's what you do. If you want to learn how to play the long short game, we're going to help you with that too. Not a lot of people play that game well, by the way, but you know, there's a lot to do here. And Brian's got a lot of names that, you know, he could go bullish on here that, you know, are down 60, 80% from their cycle highs in 2021. Real being one of them, REAL. All right. Thanks, Brian.
Thank you.
Tom.
Yeah, I put the replay up from the healthcare show yesterday. I'm trying to make this more of a part of the process and, you know, keep you up to date, keep the client up to date, keep myself up to date with a bunch of stuff. The one incremental piece was we had gone back and forth on Progyny, PGNY, a couple of weeks ago. One of the things that fell out from their quarter was, you know, sort of a slower utilization number. What I found in our tracking data as we were looking at it was that their number of providers had fallen off. So that chart's in the deck and kind of interesting. And I will put that again in your inbox over the weekend. And then also a quick call out was something that came up through the review from yesterday as I was putting some of those slides together. LifeStance flipped over to a quad factor long from, you know, being sort of middling to negative. It's been sort of this high tension stock with Hindenburg short, the recovery, the new CEO sort of making slow-ish progress relative to the price. You know, obviously making a pretty substantial turn on cash flow and beating the number, which we had previewed pretty explicitly into the number. So from here, right, it gets very interesting, I think, from meeting the demand piece with in-network, you know, because you can't really support the mental health demand without in-network prices. Like, for instance, would be a psychiatrist might charge you $750 for a 20-minute visit, say, you know, for a prescription or something. This is not something anybody can afford in any great number. So they're going to have to get insurers, at least, are going to have to provide some sort of adequate network. That'll mean prices have to go up to somebody like a LifeStance who gets about $150, $160 per. They're going to be in demand because those networks are inadequate for in-network for us as an employer. We're going to go and complain eventually, or in mass, people are going to complain, hey, I can't get somebody to see my kid, right? And that's all going to come back around. So I think we're in this stage where mental health is being normalized, or already has, but now we're on to the stage. Well, how do you actually see somebody? How do you actually get paid, get access, and, you know, have this whole thing actually function? Because it doesn't right now, because, you know, X huge percentage of mental health professionals are out of network and they're asking you to pay cash, and which isn't going to work for the vast, vast majority of people. But but flipping to quad factor positive, also the macro call with sort of the higher beta, smaller cap, you know, the progression that you guys are laying out for this year, this is kind of perfect, you know, from a factor exposure perspective. But that was flipping positive was a new chart that I had in that healthcare show from yesterday. That's it.
The name that's, if I had to buy one name that's on your list, that's, you know, because again, it's my scoring of that is bullish trade, bullish trend, low end of the range. If I have all three of those things, I want to buy it. And I want to buy it actually more aggressively than if obviously it was in the middle of its range. But Elevance, ELV. I have no idea what they do, but I know what the ticker's doing.
All right. I will get on. That's a managed care. You know, not my comfort zone, in terms of how that functions. That's really been a yield play for the most part. So if you're bullish yield, their net income margin essentially, or what they're compounding off, you know, the capital costs of on the premiums that they're making a yield on the net interest margin side, that's very, you know, highly leverageable. The medical cost trend accelerating finds its way through premium inflation, so that's also positive. And they tend to be really good, if you're big enough, to price at a spread. Obviously, we've had some issues with Humana and United Healthcare talking about that, maybe not pricing to trend, but if a trend is accelerating like I think it is, that's eventually going to find its way through on a premium The other pieces, I mean, there's obviously a whole ton of, I don't want to off the cuff here. And Emily knows a lot about this as well in terms of the Medicare Advantage marketplace, how penetrated that is, but I will, there's no reason why I can't do some work and flip you back. Sort of similar to Patterson, PDCO, get that to you in short order.
Okay, good. Thank you. Emily.
Good morning, Keith. Elevance is a big Medicaid piece, which is, I've talked about this a lot. It's not, the expectation was that it would lose members. It is not losing them as fast as we thought, and it's not returning to its baseline of 64 million people before the pandemic. This is one of the creative ways in which the government is able to keep printing money by pouring it into these mandatory programs, which makes your MCOs happy, which in turn makes your providers happy, which healthcare is 20% of GDP. So this is a trick that it's well documented that the Obama administration used in the post great financial crisis period, and with the benefit of the Affordable Care Act. That's not political, that's documented. Moving on, unless you had any questions about that.
No. I'm just,
okay. The I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
Okay. Two other things. Number one, there is a study making the rounds amongst the TV doctor crowd that the American Heart Association released just within the last couple of days that concludes that that people who smoke or take cannabis in some form are 25% more likely to experience a adverse cardiac event. It's a crappy study. It's based on a survey. It doesn't segment populations. You know, are people smoking weed every day for something that has nothing to do with you know, recreational use? Is there, we don't know. So, but it's making the rounds, it's hitting the headlines, and that's why I mentioned it. It's just not a great study. I think the point the American Heart Association is trying to make anyway is we don't have a ton of great longitudinal data on regular use of THC and cannabis. It's being developed. It's just not quite there yet. And that's why you get, you know, these kind of crappy studies jumping in there. And then lastly, Pfizer had their big oncology day yesterday. And now 40% of their employees are dedicated to the oncology sector. And they are banking a hell of a lot on their Seagen acquisition. Execution is going to be important. I point this out because if you compare what Moderna is doing, which is seriously doubling down on the mRNA platform that they used for development of the SARS-CoV-2 vaccine, and they're trying to extrapolate that to other uses. Pfizer is doing pretty much the opposite and starving that function in favor of oncology. That should tell you a lot of what you need to know about Moderna. I can't believe I'm saying anything nice about Pfizer, but there I am. So that's it.
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager-in-chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40-plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high-conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe and tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
The only thing I'm going to say nice about Pfizer is that it's been a nice short.
Well, and it still might be. I'm this the, they are putting you know, this is a what a 60 billion dollar company. They're putting a lot of eggs in their CGN basket, which is not great, but we can talk about that another day. So that's it.
Yeah, it's it acted great on the short side yesterday. Apple did. There are plenty of shorts. I mean, that's the other thing. You know, like, we're not bullish or bearish. We're executing on the process, and there's always a bull or bear market somewhere. All right. Thanks, Steinbomber.
Morning. So I want to hit on a couple things that are basically the same thing this morning. It's a follow-up to the presentation we gave yesterday on consumer credit. I think the presentation was really good. And anybody who's at all interested either in these companies or the space or even more broadly should definitely check it out. The couple of the key takeaways is that consumer credit trends appear to be stabilizing. So early cycle indicators are all getting now less bad in rate of change terms. So obviously that's a positive. We went through an absolute ton of data that looked at that through a number of different lenses. However, in the short term, there is an event risk coming up quite quickly. The CFPB, and I know Drago talked about this while I was out, but the CFPB is going to most likely issue its ruling, its final ruling around credit card late fees and the fact that it doesn't think they're fair before the State of the Union address. So the State of the Union is next week on Thursday. I think this ruling by the CFPB is, the timing is not coincidental. It's going to give President Biden something to talk about. And so, yeah, basically what the CFPB is expected to rule is that the current $40 credit card late fee regime, which generates about $12 billion in revenue for the industry, should be cut by 75%. And late fees shouldn't be more than $8. So the impact to pre-tax income for the three companies most affected by this, Discover stands to lose about 15% of its pre-tax income. Synchrony, 24, almost 25% of its pre-tax income, and Capital One, 27%. To give you just one crazy number, Synchrony last year generated $2.7 billion in late fees, and its pre-tax income was $2.9 billion. And the CFPB wants to take that down by 75%. So the good news for them is that they lay off the majority, in fact, of that to their retail partners. So that hedges them a bit. But the point is that this announcement will probably come early next week, either Monday, Tuesday, or Wednesday, most likely. And I think, you know, even though it's decently known, I think it's still going to be a shot across the bow, a big one. And I think there's likely to be short-term event risk in these stocks ahead of that. So anyway, wanted to sort of frame up both the short term and the intermediate term setups here very briefly, but people who are interested should go and check out the replay of our call we hosted yesterday. That's it for me this morning.
I was pleasantly surprised yesterday to see our asset allocation to housing hit a new high. All it took was a kind of like a dovish response, or hope is a better way to characterize it, post the PCE number on bond yields. All bond yields did, of course, was come off the top end of the range towards the low end of the range, which is you still get those rate sensitive moves in housing. And it's a great portfolio piece, Steiner, because that's what a portfolio should be. It should be diversified and also be asymmetric. Look that up if you haven't heard of that before, i.e. your portfolio isn't just like NVIDIA and moon and laser beams. It's got stuff that goes up on days when other things go down. And, you know, that's been a good piece. It's been much better. So, for example, like a lot of people that, you know, most people in their retirement accounts have like a 60-40 and have a lot of duration or bond exposure. We don't have any. You know, we're long short-term, very short-term bills, T-bills.
ball hoggers, you know, what I call them again, where you're today's payday, by the way, where we're getting paid are anywhere between 4.7 to 5% risk-free. But we're long housing. I mean, that's been a good one, man. I don't know what drove that other than the rates move. Was there news on certain builders yesterday? I mean, you know, Lennar's acted really well on my signal.
Yeah, no, there wasn't any big news. I mean, you know, if you zoom out a little bit, and I've talked about this before, but, you know, housing is a pretty boring sector, but it's outperformed tech since 2019, which is pretty wild. It's actually the only sector that's outperformed tech since 2019. And the reason for that is because there is still a massive structural supply shortage in the housing sector. And that, you know, we do these quarterly calls with Ed Pinto, and he sort of goes through, you know, the nightmare prospect of trying to increase, you know, density and planning, and how difficult it is to permit just about anything anywhere these days. And, you know, you're going to go through that. You look at the household formation rates relative to the construction rates, you look at the demographics, and none of that is poised anytime soon to change. And so the tailwinds are there. But then in the short term, as we also have talked about, housing itself reduces to this one factor model around rates, right? It's just a bond proxy. And so on the one hand, you have that longer term, very powerful tailwind, but in the short term, it really just becomes a play on rates.
Yeah, and that's definitely how it acted yesterday. So that's a nice offset. And in a long short book, it is as well, because, you know, like I'm short, I'm only short two things from a U.S. equity sector perspective, which has got to be the low for a while now, which is utilities and regional banks. And you know, regional banks, just quickly, I mean, that goes back to payday today, because we get the NYCB down like, what, another 30%? I mean, was anything incremental there, or was it just more of the same?
Well, yeah. So they basically fired their CEO. And the reason they did that is because they discovered internal control problems with respect to their loan risk evaluation process. So,
oh, wow.
Yeah. So they replaced him. They made the executive chairman, the interim CEO. So that stock, which already, of course, had lost, you know, more than half its value, down this morning between 20 and 30%, depending on the minute. So, yeah, I mean, the hits just keep on coming for New York Community. I think more broadly with regionals, you know, the backdrop here is going to be more challenging than what I just described for the consumer finance sector, because obviously, this commercial real estate office exposure overhang, it's not going to hit like a tsunami for the sector all at once. Instead, it's just going to, you know, hit more idiosyncratically. But the concern's going to be, you know, who and when, right? And so that's just going to basically cast a long shadow over the sector for the better part of the upcoming year. So it'll be, you know, it'll be a struggle for the regional banks. Relative, you know, to more broadly, either the financial sector or the broader market. So, yeah, we're just going to kind of get these episodic updates from different companies that aren't great over the course of, you know, the next three or four earnings reporting seasons.
Hi, I'm Keith McCullough, and I wanted to introduce you to my favorite product at HedgEye, The Macro Show. Why is it my favorite product? Well, it's my show. I do that every morning. If you want to get ready for the market day, you want to contextualize all the data, you want to make good decisions, and this is what you should be watching. It's a repeatable process that you can deliberately study, measuring and mapping time series to time series of data. So it's not going headline to headline and getting whipped around. It's actually being so much more dispassionate about it and making good decisions that are data driven. So we'd love to have you on our team. Come join us.
Tune in weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern and on demand anytime. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe.
Another tough one for drawdown, Josh Brown. He's I guess he went into one of the banks and he liked what he saw. I mean, really, dude, it's so bad, so bad. The retail community that bought that based on these CNBC clowns, I mean, I guess to his credit, he wouldn't really know if a financial firm didn't have internal controls, because he used to work at a boiler room brokerage that got basically decayed by the police and shut down. So he wouldn't know. I mean, you got to feel bad for the guy a little bit sometimes. Okay. Thank you. Rob, yeah? Got no Rob Simone today?
Oh, no, Keith, sorry, I was on mute. I'm here. Sorry about that. I'm here. I was talking, but didn't pick it up. It's kind of quiet in the sense that I'm just playing catch up after earnings, after like marketing for the last couple of days. But last night, MPW did file their 10K, which is always a labor of love, I guess you could call it. One call out. This is wild. So the auditor letter, first of all, that like the lawyers basically tore up and rewrote the entire 10K, which is hilarious. Lots of billable hours there. I mean, I used to say that only the MPW's management team was winning in this whole thing, but now like you could probably add the lawyers to that. Just incredible. I did a black line of the K versus, it's basically like the whole risk section was just deleted, like lined out and completely rewritten.
Really?
Oh, it's nuts. That's an exaggeration, but like a significant portion of it. In the auditor's letter, the one thing that I wanted to highlight, and that's really meaningful for this company, you know, vis-a-vis their debt covenants, you know, specifically the revolver covenants, they have a tangible net worth test. That's a maintenance covenant. And they have about, on my numbers, call it like $900 million of flexibility before they would trip that covenant or need a waiver. And obviously, they don't have the ability to sell equity right now. If you think through that number, that 900 million, they're carrying on their books, call it, you know, over $1 billion. If you include the book value of the Macquarie JV, over $1 billion of investments still in Steward, and another 700 million in prospect, like the majority of which, if not all of that, I believe is worthless. So get a load of this. When you read the auditor's letter, They did take $700 million of impairments in the quarter related to Steward, but they left the book value, that over $1 billion remaining outstanding, because they valued Steward using a revenue multiple approach, which is just phenomenal. But like, I like, okay, great. Like, let's just watch how that one ends, because that is tremendous. I hope PwC, if there's anyone on PwC, from PwC on the call this morning, go get yourself a lawyer today, because when this blows up, it will, there's almost like, to my mind, like the collateral damage here is going to be epic. And that is outrageous. Like that entity is worthless. And you're using revenue multiples to justify avoiding MPW taking write-downs. I wonder how the bank group feels about that. I wonder how the state of Massachusetts feels about that, and all the doctors and nurses, et cetera. But like, let's just watch how that one plays out. It is going to be phenomenal to watch. So anyway, just wanted to highlight that. And phenomenal in a bad way, to be clear.
Do you have the names of the people from
Sorry, you broke up there, Keith. I missed that.
I said, do you have the individual names of the people from, did you say Pricewaterhouse that did this?
I don't. I believe that the audit partner for PwC, but by the way, it's of course audited by the local Birmingham office. Let's just throw that one in there.
Nice. Of course.
Yeah. That's a fun one too. I'd love to, I'd love to sit in on that, you know, that golf club dining room conversation about 3 weeks ago. That would have been a fun one, just to be a fly on the wall. But the guy's name is Sparks, or yeah, he was the old audit partner. I think they may have actually gotten a new one. But candidly, I don't know their names. I just know that they've had the same auditor for basically their entire existence. They used the local Birmingham office, and they used a revenue multiple on Steward, on a worthless Steward that is currently under a forbearance agreement with its ABL lenders, aka it's in default. They used a revenue multiple to value Steward and determined that MPW had $1 billion of value justified on its balance sheet. Like, again, let's just watch that one play out. That's what I would posit to the world.
Well, let's also make it come to life. I mean, think of all the times that everyone listening to this has heard about auditors or self-dealing, self-dealing auditors that have cleanly overseen things like Enron or something like this. And there's never really a name, right? So let's find the names. I want to know, like, if it's Sparks, I want to know who the person is that runs the PwC
Terry
Birmingham
Sparks.
Office.
Terry Sparks. That's the guy's name. Terry.
And does he run the Birmingham office?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure.
Let's find him. I want his name. And I also want the person that he reports to. There's going to be, you know, if the government's not going to do anything, we'll do something.
It's crazy. It's nuts. It's nuts. And it's criminal. Like, I mean, really, that is, we have a company that's under a forbearance agreement with its lenders that is using. It's crazy.
We got it. I mean, so let's start making it more real for these people and holding them to account. Again, if we're going to live in a country where the authorities don't want to do that, then we'll still do. We have communication platforms that can certainly hold people to account. And for you, the people out there, you know, participate. You know, sitting idle is what people do in communist countries, in countries where you don't give a fuck, right? We care about liberty. We care about the rule of law. You need to care, right? Help us. Yeah, this is wrong. It's just wrong.
It's wrong. It's
right?
Just
we
wrong.
We got to keep going here.
It's wrong.
Yeah, it's awful. I mean, Jay, I'll flip to Jay. Jay Van Sciver, how many times, and we're not with the first year, but how many, I've read a lot of Ks and Qs, 10Ks. How many times have you read a 10K where the thing is essentially, you know, completely changed in the risk section like that? That's not a frequent thing.
Oh, it's a great indicator of stock that's about to go down. I remember when Sarbanes-Oxley came out in the early aughts, right? You saw GE, for example, their 10K went from like 80 pages to like 300 pages. Like it was people afraid about going to jail, and suddenly started disclosing a bunch of things. You know, we, you know, for the benefit of people on the call who don't know, we're in 10K season. So you're going to hear a lot more about auditors and audit letters and, you know, disclosures, risks and stuff than you normally would on the call. We have one out this morning, which I'll talk about in a sec. But it's an important source. SEC filings are where companies typically, you know, try and tell the truth, because they can be held to account for that on a different level than they can in a press release, which is more, you know, fluffy and friendly and bullish, right? The bad news will be in the K's and Q's. So we're back from what I would say was three absolutely packed days of meetings in London. Good round. A little wiped out from it, but we have our show today at 10 a.m., at 11 a.m., the industrial show. We'll go through Beacon's pre-announcement. We'll go through some things on the emissions deck and some things in the ag deck. Then at 2 p.m., we're going to go through the Ag Apocalypse Part 2, the biofuels edition, looking at biodiesel and sustainable aviation fuel, which are kind of the pushbacks we got to the ethanol bear case. So, you know, we'll explain why. Basically, we didn't spend a lot of time in them in the first deck, and what we see going on there. So that's worthwhile. One thing that's out this morning is Plug Power, which reported a pretty sizable loss and disappointment. The funny thing is they did release their 10K before the press release because they were removing the going concern language that was in their 10Q last quarter, right? So last quarter they said, we might go bankrupt. And now they're saying, we're not going to go bankrupt in this operating cycle. And that's because they sold $1.3 billion of stock for cash, right? So they're going to burn that cash. And to put that in context, this is a company with a $2.4 billion market cap. So the dilution is just massive. But, you know, for an investor, issuing stock to fund operating losses isn't exactly the going concern removal that they think it is, right? That isn't really how companies are supposed to. It's one thing if you're like issuing stock to build a capital asset that'll last for a long time, but just, you know, funding the purchase of something to sell it at a loss is not that great. The other thing that just jumps out is that gross profit or gross loss increased by more than revenue, right? Like you should at least be able to buy and resell something at like roughly break even, not at an enormous loss. So that is just a mess of an earnings release. I think the company thought the removal of going concern language would make the stock go up. It's down, I don't know, 8-10% in pre-market. That call is starting now, but you know, eventually if the economy reaccelerates, probably drop shorts like Plug, but it is not a real going concern. I'll leave it there.
Again, like I said earlier in the week, you were while you were in London, you know, I had a dream. You know, it's not, I wasn't trying to be MLK, obviously, but one of my dreams is that, and it's still manifesting here in reality, is that we're going to be some version of the police as a community, right? The Hedgeye community is growing at a faster rate. To have people on Free Access Week, we got a lot of people that are watching this. And when people, corporate, white collar, you know, I don't know if you're going to call what Plug Power, I wouldn't call it white collar crime, but you'd certainly say it lacks principle to the core, where, again, they sell you stock, right? Whether Plug Power, whoever bought that stock is a pension fund, a mutual fund, an index fund, they sell you stock. They pay themselves compensation, and then they burn the cash. That's it.
That's not even being the police. It's just like, that's what's going on. It's just, you're just telling the truth. The financials are hilarious. It's like stand up
and part of the
financials.
Part of the burn is what they pay themselves, right? I mean, so it lacks principle to the core. People for so long, they don't trust Wall Street for these reasons, but now they're going to get a fine appreciation for the names of people at specific companies that are doing particular things that we're monitoring in real time. All right, so great job with that one. That's been one of the great shorts in Hedgeye history, Plug Power. And to those of you that have ran that company into the ground, shame on you. All right, Friedman.
Yep, morning. So we had Fubo earnings out this morning, which is still a short of ours. The stock's up pre-market on a headline EBITDA beat, but digging through the numbers here, the fundamental story remains the same. Total subscriber growth slowed to 8.5% in Q4. That's from 19% in Q3 and 42% in the fourth quarter of 22, so the year ago period. They guided fiscal year 2024. They operate on a calendar year, but 2024 subscriber growth guide to only 2.8%. So further deceleration, which is a problem for a high churn business model. They talk about gross margins being positive on a GAAP basis, but what they don't include in their COGS, but should, is broadcasting and transmission costs, about $15.5 million. So if we add that back and comparing it to subscription revenue, you get a 0% gross margin business on the subscription side. So not really seeing much evidence of scale that's needed to really turn this business around. Again, we think it's a broken business model and that there's real no path to profitability here. And on that point, for the year, GAAP operating loss was $289 million, which was a slight improvement, an improvement rather, versus 22 of $411 million on cost-cutting efforts, but still deeply, deeply negative. The company burned about $195 million in cash in 2024. In 2023, they have $245 million in cash on the balance sheet. They say that they're on track to hit positive free cash flow targets by 2025. I just still don't know how they get there. So I think between now and then, they're going to have to raise equity capital again in the first half of this year, which will be further diluted to the stock, and then you know likely miss their free cash flow positive targets unless if they do some type of you know transformative deal, which again I think is not likely. So still short Fubo. The call's happening as we speak, so I'll have to hop on that.
Yeah, that thing's a raging POS too. I mean. Fridays, I guess we're just rolling out all the pieces of shit that we've shorted. Plug Power, MPW, Fubo. I mean, man. But those executives sold you all stock. Not everybody on the call, of course. You know what I mean. Felix, I see you on, but you're not supposed to be on. Or did you want to say something? Nope. All right. He's just multitasking because I think he's on a client call. No Glenshire today, so no bad jokes, JT.
Oh, guys, what a great way to start the weekend.
Although he did slip one into that email to us. So was like,
oh, he just can't help himself. That's the problem. He just can't help himself, that guy. So we did avert yet another shutdown, Keith.
Thank God. Thank
I know. God.
They saved us from themselves.
Again.
Would that cost another $500 trillion?
Yeah. I was thinking about this. It was like if you or I, you know, showed up at work every day and didn't do our jobs, right? What would our clients do, right? They drop us in a heartbeat if we didn't put in the work, didn't put in the time. It's like we're 5 months into the fiscal year. They're still dilly-dallying with this, and then they're going to turn around. They're going to need to start 2025, you know, in within a matter of weeks. It's ludicrous that it's gone on to March now, and maybe even trickle into April, and then they take these recesses. Just get everyone here and just get it done. You know, this is Congress. This is what we're paying for, right? And this is probably hawks on both of their houses. Probably the lowest productivity Congress. In decades, if not ever.
Ever.
Do nothing Congress. So but of the remaining things that we're going to be looking at in March, Keith, is going to be finishing up these bills first and foremost. And it looks as if I'd probably say there's a 50-60% chance, maybe 60% chance they get six of these bills passed next week. And then on to the tougher ones, which have a timeline of March 22nd. In that time frame, they're going to have to make some decisions on that tax bill that we talked about, the childcare tax credit, coupled with the business tax breaks. That's sort of in limbo in the Senate and just getting a lot of pushback. It was passed in a bipartisan way in the House, getting a lot of pushback from mainly Republican senators in the Senate. That's going to be up in the air in March, as well as foreign aid. My prediction is, at least on the foreign aid side, that Johnson will end up doing what he's done on these spending bills, which is probably looking for a majority of his conference coupled with Democrats, maybe even attaching it to the spending bill in late March and getting that done and moving on. Why take two tough votes when you can combine it? And for the time being, at the beginning of the week, I said, you know, what sort of the path forward for Johnson and others is going to be determined as to whether he sides with the Freedom Caucus types or sort of the bulk of his conference and just getting stuff done. Like this will be, again, not just lowest productivity Congress, but we'll probably stop legislating in March, April. I think May's a big push. Typically in an election year, you see them passing some stuff in the summertime before just calling it quits for an election year. I think this is going to be unlike any other year, and they're going to stop legislating. And it's just tough. I mean, Johnson's got a 2-seat majority, and what can you possibly pass? And Schumer's got a 1-seat majority. What can you possibly pass in this environment in an election year? So those are the three things that'll be up. The rest of the spending bills, the tax bill, which I know a lot of guys, clients are watching. And of course, this foreign aid piece that I think, you know, with McConnell's retirement here, I think that's going to be one of the last things he wants to try to get done before all is said and done. And that might be the last tranche of foreign funding we've seen quite some time. And that's it, Keith.
That's a lot. Yeah, we hit on the rule of law. We hit on, like, look, I got this flag behind me. I'm Canadian, right? And I'm trying to get all of you to participate, you know, to wake people up. Like JT said earlier in the week, and thanks for joining us throughout the week, you know, go up to somebody in the grocery store, go up to your congressman, go up to somebody and just like remind them that the inflation in the grocery store is a function of the deficit and the debt. I mean, just going on and on and on. It's not going to be, you might like the color and you might like, you know, you might, I mean, I have a Canadian flag tattooed on my back, but I don't like their politics. I mean, you might like the look of that American flag and it stands for a lot more than a lot of other countries, but man, it's not a perpetuity if you don't do something, right? So something to think about. Thanks for joining us for this week. We appreciate it. And for all of our HedgeEye subscribers and our community, we'll see you again on Monday.
Don't forget to check out HedgeEye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @HedgeEye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by HedgeEye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. HedgeEye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of HedgeEye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by HedgeEye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.